Hello and Happy New Year. I'm James Sandy and this is the New Curiosities Box, a fresh slice of arts and culture for the plenty 20s from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we take an extended look at Peter Pan reimagined at the Birmingham Rep by way of a conversation with some of the cast and some exclusive music from the show composed by Asaf Zahar. And we conclude our current series of interviews from Digbeth's Grand Union by way of an intriguing exchange with sonic artist Sajan Kuna. If you're new for 2020 or just want to catch up with over 30 shows to date, you can find more information and an archive at www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. We start with an epic story lovingly rebooted for the modern age. J.M. Barrie's 1904 tale of the boy who wouldn't grow up is creatively rewired for 21st century Birmingham by way of Peter Pan reimagined, conceived and directed by Liam Steele, and playing at the Rep Birmingham until Sunday, the 19th of January 2020. To help me understand its enduring themes and the dynamics of this fresh new production, I caught up with Hook and Wendy, also known as cast members Nia Gwynn and Cora Tang, to place the magic in context. Okay, so I'm with Nia and Cora, who very excitingly are members of the cast of Peter Pan Reimagined. And we have Hook and Wendy.
Hello.
Hi.
Excellent. I'm very excited about being interviewed, I can tell. Now, let's start with this particular version of Peter Pan, because it is a reimagined version. It's quite a realistic, kind of life-focused version, isn't it?
It's accessible, I think. It's accessible to the people of Birmingham, and it's much more relatable than Victorian Peter Pan would have been.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it takes on sort of the mantle, if you like, of J.M. Barrie's original story, but it places it in a very, very urban, very modern setting.
Yeah, we're introduced to Wendy at her foster home, which is on an estate, possibly in Birmingham, for the purposes of this. Yes, Birmingham, you'll hear a lot of Brummie accents. So I think immediately there's something that people in the audience can recognise. They're hearing things they recognise, they're seeing things they recognise. And I think that then sort of gives you much more freer access to each other as audience and actors. You're very immediately in the same world together.
And a lot of people will hear the words Peter Pan and see the name Peter Pan and they will instantly think panto. Oh yes, they will. I can hear people crying. But it's never really, I guess it has been sort of adapted for pantomime, but it's more, I guess, of a kind of social commentary. And traditionally when it was a Victorian sort of piece and play, it was very much about, the time almost forbidding people's childhood and stopping them from being young and, making them grow up quick, wasn't it? Was that?
Yeah, which is kind of the opposite take from what we're kind of doing. We're not doing making kids grow up. We're allowing kids to be kids and allowing Wendy's sort of become like a young carer for her brothers, and it's her allowing herself to have some sort of freedom and be a child again and play, which I think is, it's the social commentary on today's world where kids are kind of have a lot more responsibility than they need to.
Yeah, I think children are forced to grow up quicker than is perhaps better for them, the more terribly modern and technologically savvy we think we are. I think childhood loses out. And so what you do get with the lost ones in this is children really being children. Of course, they're played by adult actors, but they're very, very young. And I think that's why the play is so timeless, because there's something about enjoying watching children being children. And certainly as adults, I love watching children being children, It's something lovely about
it. There's a magic, isn't
there? There is a magic to it. And
it's just an innocence, but there's something.
Yeah,
isn't there?
And I think that's why the play sustains, because we all love to watch that.
So when the stage is illuminated, the first thing people see is, I think it's called Neverland Court. Is that
the name? Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Sort of housing, I guess high rise
estate, yeah,
that kind of thing. And I think people are just like, oh, hold on, this is a bit different. You know,
yeah.
This is an interesting take. Now, one thing occurred to me while I was watching this, I've never thought about this before, but Neverland is obviously a kind of a realm of imagination. But it's also maybe, I might be wrong about this, but it's also maybe about flying, okay? And the idea of, you know, following your dreams and flying away and never landing, you know, never kind of grounding them.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I think that's a big part in this show, that it's about hope and lifting you up. And the way that that is written is that the one happy thought to lift you up doesn't necessarily mean about flying. It means about life. It means about not forgetting your past, but moving on from the sad things in life by just thinking of something happy. And that's kind of the theme through the whole play, I think, which comes from that Neverland situation.
I can always catch you, falling star. If I could just see where you are, you know you don't always need to fight, because you know I'll make it right. Catch you, shooting star. If I could just see where you are, you don't always have to fly away, because you know I'm here to stay.
And you do also fly in the production, which is very exciting. So there's a lot of physicality to the performance. And
the flying is amazing. I don't fly. Everyone's very pleased about that. No one more so than me. But the flying is astonishing. It's so beautiful. Cora and the others.
Yeah. I think there's six of us that fly. There's myself and the actors that play Michael and John, the actor that plays Peter, and Tinkerbell. Wow. So I think we all fly, and it is a lot of fun, and it's done in a way that I don't think people have seen done. It's done, it's like bungee assisted instead of it being just like technical. So it's a whole cast thing. So even though there's five people flying on stage, there's also five people off stage working, like, counterbalancing and climbing. And so it's amazing the things we can do, because it becomes part of the play. It doesn't just become, oh my God, they're flying. It becomes like a whole thing in itself within the play.
Yeah, there's a whole physical language, isn't
that we
see developing, and it is stunning and really hard work. And they never complain.
And it's a lot of fun once you're through it.
Once you've cracked it.
Once we've got it, and you've got the trust with the person that's on the other side of the rope from you, it's a lot of fun. It's great fun.
I think one thing that struck me about what the cast were very, not easily able to do, but it looked effortless. You know, it looked like you've been flying for years. But obviously, as you know, from what you said, there's a lot of hard work and training that goes into that, and practice. You know, it's not something you just, you know, clip on a bungee and jump up.
It's a lot of work. We put a lot of work into it.
Takes phenomenal expertise. I mean,
yeah.
It can't be underestimated how much expertise it takes, not only to fly, but to be one of the counterbalancers. And these guys absolutely nailed it in five short, very short weeks.
Yeah.
With just morning sessions. It's breathtaking.
And there are, I think it's fair to say, a lot of people on the stage in terms of, you know, support.
It's a big company,
stagehands and crew. And very cleverly, the shadows, let's call them that, not Cliff Richard's backing band, to be clear. the shadows kind of appear very early, and they're almost menacing when they appear, some kind of
figures,
but then again they disappear and enable some of the cast to do some quite extraordinary things.
Yeah, the introduction to the shadows is so clear that when the shadows are there and they're in the show and they're around, you kind of stop noticing them and you don't realise. And the majority of the shadows are cast, so that are the rest of the cast when they're not on stage, they're a shadow. Two of the assistant stage managers, they are also shadows. Mm-hmm. I think, because there's no way of hiding someone getting clipped onto a bungee on stage. There's no way of hiding it. So you have to make it part of the show. You have to make it part of the show, or else it
looks...
They're
kind of sort of theatrical ninjas, aren't they, really?
They are, yeah. And it's an ensemble show.
Yeah, more so than any show I've ever done. It utterly relies on everybody pulling together, and it people have worked so hard and they make it look effortless, all of it. Every single person on that stage is doing more than one job.
Yeah.
Everybody. There's so much going on, and it's magical because when it comes together, and we're at the stage now when it has.
Yeah.
It's very beautiful. It's a big, beautiful machine of a show.
You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy, on Switch Radio 107.5. Now, art can be a curious beast, largely the point of this show. Beyond painting and sculpture, sound art and creative sonics is an increasingly complex genre to work out. In the final part of our series of interviews with creative talent from Digbeth's Grand Union, I spoke to sonic artist Sir Jan Kuna about memory, feeling, emotion, and sound.
So I'm with Sir Jan Kuna, and here at Grand Union. And Sir Jan, let's start with talking about who you are and what you do, because all I know so far is that you're an artist.
Yeah.
And that means lots of things. So give us some more definition on that.
So I guess it depends on your practice or how you sort of operate within the artistic sphere, but like I'm interested in artists moving image work, and I predominantly make, like, I've been more recently actually making films, and I made a trailer for a film which I showed at something we at ESAP project called Summer Camp, and I just showed the trailer, and the trailer was sort of an exploration or a test, I guess, of some of the ideas I'm thinking about, especially relationship between sort of memory, like violence and trauma, and like these spheres of like extraction of those things. I predominantly like messing around with sonic like equivalences, like how sound can manipulate someone's spatial senses. The trailer was 4 minutes to be exact, and it basically follows a three-arc trajectory. The first arc looking at analysing like three matriarchal figures in my family, making them three-dimensional and on an iPhone. And then the second part, half of the seventh part of the trailer, is an exploration of like objects which are both follow on from, like, I guess, a remnants or extracts from colonialism in my family house, and then the final part of the film is just an observation of my mother looking at an image. And throughout that, my mom is actually trying to describe, or using her memory, trying to construct her historic village in India. And the base of all this sounds very complicated, but the base of all this was actually a track from a Bollywood song, which I've heard throughout my whole life. It was slowed down, and through an echo on a editing equipment I did, I put through an echo, and it just sounded very hypnotic and quite sensuous. And I'm really interested in how sound can manipulate an environment.
So there's a lot there.
That's how I think.
Very colourful. So let's try and not deconstruct, let's try and unpack that slightly. So let's start with the first element of that, which you talked about, memory.
Yeah.
Okay, and I suppose how we remember things, or things we forget, perhaps. How did you come to that as an idea?
Well, I guess the idea of how we produce, or like, I guess it's like memory as an ontological tool, like a state of being, I'm really interested in. Like the way that it can be a form of architecture, and the way it behaves when people are trying to look like beyond themselves. And then we have this other layer of it, which is collective memory, which is when we all share a certain moment together. I like the sort of distance between that individual trying to recall something and the collective narrative around it. And that's sort of like that, of course, like the in-between space is always very interesting, because you have this like really big distance between both things.
But and have you always done that through film? Has film always been your focus? Or?
No, I think more recently, because I feel like there's more potential for what I'm interested in. And I've always, like, the thing I like about film or moving image work a lot is it kind of demands attention. It's got like a gravitas, like it's got a weight, like an arrogance of like how it can bring its body into a space. It doesn't, like a sculpture or like a painting or like a drawing, or I think the closest I see filmmaking is to performance, because it occupies a certain realm which some things can't for me or in my practice.
Do you mean it kind of, it demands, it's sort of immediate, it demands your attention?
Yeah, and I think if you play with it in many ways, it kind of behaves, how do I explain this now, it's quite interesting to talk about, because I just see it as a gravitas, like a bodily arrogance, like it just waltzes in and it just takes over. And you can do that with, I think one of the ways I've done that quite a lot with the trailer was to do with the sonic sphere of the film as well, or the trailer, sorry, which means I completely occupied a room without necessarily needing any like physical, or leaving any physical trace of itself. That's kind of what I guess I'm trying to get to. Yeah.
So technically, when you're putting together a film project, and you mentioned kind of sonic art as well, which we'll touch on that in a moment, but technically, what kind of film are you using? You said you mentioned an iPhone.
Yeah.
But are you using very sort of accessible modern tech?
Yeah,
or are you using Super 8s, or what are you doing?
No, actually, the interesting thing is, but I'll kind of get on to the next moment, but like I try to be, not democratic, but I try to use what's available for me, and I think an iPhone is a pretty incredible tool, because it's got an architecture which is approximate to the body, so it fits into your hand, and it also has a familiarity for everyone. The screen, the portrait mode, and also the landscape mode, they have a very specific set of rules you can do with them, and I think that's what I kind of like about it. And I feel like most people own some sort of smartphone, and they have some sort of relationship to that, and they can document and construct their own stories out of that, and I find that really quite weirdly liberating for the way I make film. I just wouldn't be interested right now in like having like a high-end like visual team like making my work. But in terms of like high eight and everything, I've actually recently inherited, I don't know how I found this, but I found 150 hours of footage from India, which was taken between the early 2000s and 2010 on a camcorder. And it's a mixture of scenes. I've seen some of those so far. I'm getting them actually transferred to DVD so I can edit them and push them maybe into a longer body of work. But the scenes with like the snakes fighting on lakes, and there's these incredible like charmers across the streets in like parts of Punjab. So I've got that, which I have to go through as well. So there's like this, like that's how kind of my work evolves. Like there's this weird type of investigation into history and like trauma, and then it impacts on us finding all these weird moments or these weird objects which can be forced into a space.
So you mentioned the sonic aspect of that, which I think is technically slightly more complicated than iPhones potentially.
Yeah.
So how important is that aspect in terms of underlining the visual, in terms of helping the piece form?
That's an interesting one, because I haven't really had enough time to think about that. But I think you do. I think, well, it's just weird, because I guess I'm trying to process how, like a thump or like a bass, these things are, they kind of have this, like, how do I describe it? It's kind of like going to a club, like this afterglow of a club, like when you're waiting outside at 2 a.m. and there's like a glow. That's what like bass and like, especially the sounds I tend to use, they have this idea of like, either something's just finished or it's sort of like about to happen.
I'm thinking a bit like a kind of vapor trail.
Yeah, so that's probably a really good metaphor for that. Like this, this atmosphere, like a fog, like which always exists. I don't tend to do too much of metaphors. But I think, because I don't really know how to talk too much about my sonic work, they sort of, that's a really good way of talking about them, actually. It's like this idea of a weather phenomenon, like suddenly a drastic change comes in, like it's a fog or it's like a vapor trail or like some sort of like phenomenological event has occurred. I don't like to think of them just as like music, because there's things I do to sound, like I'll push my voice through a modulator to make it sound like demonic, or make it sound like there's these things I want very specific. Like, I want very specific things out of my sound, like my voice or the sound I do mess around with.
I think that's a really important distinction, isn't it? Many people think it's music and sound, but it's more about sort of creative audio, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or audible things.
Yeah. It's like an atmosphere. There's a lot of filmmakers who do really incredible things with sound, and some don't. But the ones who do tend to do things, the way they do it is they think of it as a landscape that a body will occupy. And that's how I sort of see sound, as much as the image of what I deal with. But seeing sound, I understand, but like hearing sound, I guess, is this atmospheric thing. Yeah.
Now, a couple of other things you mentioned in that very colourful description to start with were, you mentioned family, you mentioned Bollywood, and you mentioned colonialism.
Yeah.
I picked that word out there. Yeah. Now, these are all very important themes, particularly in terms of where we are.
Yeah.
Kind of Birmingham has a whole host of sort of things to say about those things. Other places do as well, but what I mean is, they are very pertinent themes. So how How is your work, how much of Birmingham is in your work, if you like?
I think Birmingham was interesting. It's like the first place my family, when they left India, they came to the Midlands, and Birmingham was like, I guess, what the Midlands was then. So it has that connection to it. I've always found Birmingham quite interesting because I think that it's got this ability to morph into what you need it to be. It's a city which is quite like elastic. It doesn't hold, like, I find the interesting when, like, we're having this, like, I guess this, all this development and everything going on, and we're comparing ourselves to London and all these other cities, but I think the interesting about Birmingham is the fact that people have managed to create narratives and communities without the need of, like, external pressures, you know, or, like, there's just this ability for people to be, like, my family, I've always thought of, because they came here, they had to leave some type of history behind and reproduce a history here, but this is now more freeing in many ways because it's now sort of like conditions of being held onto in India, I guess.
There's a difference in pace, isn't there, I think, in terms of, I don't mean Birmingham as a slow place, but what I mean is in comparison to other perhaps bigger cities, you know, there is much more of an evolution of things, I guess. It's not, you know, it's not things just having to keep up all the time. It's, you know, it's kind of doing things and finding out things in your own way.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that's got to do with the fact that when I was living in London, the interesting thing was there's a demand that you're always active. There's always, like, a lot going on. There's always, you should be able to utilize everything. But you're also overwhelmed by it all. I think Birmingham is far more selective and has a wider collaborative approach to, like producing spaces. I just find that with the art scene and Digbeth is like that as well. Actually, there's a sphere that you can interact with people in a much more, like, democratic way. And things are less sort of, like, hierarchical. But I do think that, like, the way that I operate with Birmingham, it does have that, like, interesting pace, which I enjoy working with it. And I don't feel like it demands exhaustion by the end of the day. You know?
So, talking about the work that you've done, and you say you've worked on trailers, and kind of, I guess, snapshots. Are they snapshots of films that have yet to be made, or are they snapshots of things that sit on their own right? Or
I see them as propositions for frames to develop the next thing. I think that they're going to, because things evolve for me, the way I work is very forensic. I tend to, like, build, like, ideas up, and then, like, the making starts happening through those ideas. I don't really interact that much, like, day to day in the studio with, like, sitting there and constantly making things. I tend to just always reflect and try and produce knowledge, like writings or language. And the predominant part of my practice, which is probably most pertinent, is the fact that I write before I make. So writing is a huge part of it, but I never really disclose, like, a set of parameters or talk about that, because I always like keeping that on the, like, DL. Like, it's my, like, it's my way of operating. And then, the work gets produced. But the trailers, I see them as propositions, and that's very important because it means that something's about to happen. And there's always this, like, this notion of, like, something is about to occur, something's about to shift, instead of, like, this momentary, you know, thing that's about to occur. You know? That's how I see it.
And obviously, as you just described, you're quite guarded about that writing process. But is that a methodical process? What I mean by that is, do you sit sort of 9 to 5, you know, at a desk trying to write, and then, you know, sort of, I go out for a cup of tea afterwards, or are you writing all the time, capturing pieces as you go, or how do you approach that sort of practical working?
I guess it's more fragmented. I don't think I have the discipline or the obedience to be at a desk. I have tried. I mean, the interesting thing about having a practice is you always try to develop, like, strategies or structures to keep yourself. But I always find actually being more fluid and, like, allowing periods of, like, a few weeks to go by where you haven't actually done too much is, that's just personal to me because I understand how I work. But I tend to write predominantly, like, there'll be periods of, like, weeks where I'm constantly writing, like, and then there'll be periods where I'm not writing too much. And what I find the best way, or what's worked really beneficial to my practice, is that there'll be a lot of writing, and then that'll be dissected and produced, like, slowly I'll start, like, linking or shifting ideas and bringing in, like, real, like, physical materials I want to mess around with. So it's very, I always think that the studio space should be centered around very dynamic, fluid making space. Like, you don't worry too much about, like, the conditions of what's about to happen, or, like, you don't worry too much about what's going to look like. You're kind of just messing around. My studio is I have a studio at Grand Union, and I use it if I need to shoot films, or I tend to use it as a space where I need to go to either store or host and, like, a video, like a filming session. I try to make all my ideas happen as close as possible to where I read, live, and think, because I feel like then it's weirdly more intimate, and you always have, like, there's a weird sensuousness when you're, like, at your dining table or at, like, you know, your sofa, or you're watching, like, Netflix. Like, there's like there's these weird moments where you feel like there's a sensuousness that you can mess around with, whereas I don't feel like I could have that if I had a, like, here. That's the only difference.
So let's talk about here at Grand Union. And as a space and as a community, how has that worked for you? How has that helped your journey as an artist, if you like?
The great thing I can mention, actually, is that Grand Union is really, really open and shares ideas very well. And they have, the studio space is really great because you get to, like, sometimes... I share it with a friend of mine. Her name is Annabelle. And we both sort of utilise it when we need to. She's thinking more about workshops and her own practice in a different way. And I just tend to be very, like, you know, a film. And then we also have Modern Clay with markers. And we had we did really amazing workshops there where we're making our own, like, bowls and cups and mugs for summer school. My friend was running in London. So, I mean, it's just hard to describe other than dynamic because everything's going on. They have programming. They have, like, huge amounts of, like, interesting events. And then they have studio spaces, so it's a very sort of like holistic 360 experience for a new practitioner. I think that's incredible. Like, it's quite hard to get that. Like, I think it's quite hard to find spaces like that, which have studio spaces and gallery program, and now, like, developing a new gallery as well, which I got to see the tour of, which is also really cool. yeah.
So just to finish, are there places online that people can look and find your work?
Oh, making a website right now. This is the first time I'm going to coding. Like, this is what happens. I was like, this is how it worked. The website was never a thought.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm making one. I'm going to hopefully have it ready and slick up by the end of the year. But it's kind of like, yeah, the visual is behaving like a desktop. So, but I wanted to sort of be like this, like, it's coded, so it's quite interesting.
Okay.
Don't know if you know much about coding, but, like,
it's not really, a great deal.
It's basically you have to, like, code to make a website. Some people do really easy websites where you can, which are really good sometimes for artists. It's just like a portfolio of their work. Other people have more like spaces where they put things up. I want to treat it more like a space where some of the writing and the, like, maybe even a Google Sheet can exist so people can see what I'm up to, you know, mentally, like those sort of things.
So very kind of direct experience for folks.
I want them to basically feel like they're falling into my film, you know.
So for folks out there thinking about getting more involved in film or in sonic art or, you know, kind of audio work, what would you say to them? What would you say if they're sitting at home, not quite sure what they can do with their iPhone, but they've got an idea, what would you say to them?
Well, it's just about, like you have to, I think it's important to go and see things, experience different art making methods. Actually, my least favorite type of art is visual art. I love going to, like, the shows, and there's incredible shows happening across the country now, and I think everyone should be, like, actively investigating. And Birmingham's really a great host for tons of different variety of arts, and there's Digbeth Weekender coming up, which is really great because there's a 2-3 day event of Digbeth art scene. There's so much happening, and if they're thinking about actually making films, they should just, like, mess around and do it. Like, iPhone is incredible. You have editing software on there. You have everything you can possibly need to make something. And you can just upload it and test it out. I guess it's just have fun.
I think that's a powerful message on which to end.
Yeah, cool.
Excellent. But thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For more information on Grand Union's programme, studios and community, go to grand-union.org.uk. And there'll be more from them on this show later in the year. Now back to Peter Pan Reimagined, which runs until the 19th of January at the Rep Birmingham.
Let's talk about some of the main kind of characters of sort of which traditionally people will recognise Peter Pan for. So let's start with Hook. Now, a lot of people will see Captain Hook as a kind of, I guess, the sort of Dustin Hoffman style, you know, from the film of a long time ago.
Yeah.
But you play Hook in a very different way, don't you?
Well, yes, because I'm a woman.
Yeah, so that's the first obvious
And Hook was written to be a woman. When Barry wrote it, the part was written for an actress. And I think, because quite clearly this play is about mothers and missing mothers and what it is to be a mother. And it was written to be played by an actress. But the leading actor in the company noticed that she had all the best lines and all the best costumes, and so said to the director, well, I want to play it. And then a precedent was set. And it's only now that it's being reclaimed by actresses. I'm playing it here. I have a dear friend who's playing it in Chester. And I think there have been other female Hooks over the last year. At last. And it's refreshing. And it makes sense. The play is about lost mothers, so it makes sense.
Yo ho, 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 yo ho.
cause in a minute you about to see a slaying.
I trim the sails and I swab the decks.
Yo!
I got my weapon, I'ma keep you in check.
Ho!
Our ship is loaded with gold and jewelry, and we ain't standing for any tomfoolery.
Up your act.
I have you tarred and feathered, prepare to be shook.
You rue the day you mess with
Captain Hook.
A pirate you were meant to be.
I think the Wendy Darling character. Wendy Darling is a name in itself that sounds a little fluffy.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
But Wendy in this is very much a very forthright, outspoken kind of matriarchal figure, isn't she?
She's. I mean, yeah. She's. I play it Scottish. I play it as I am. I play her as a 15-year-old girl who's not had a mother, who's been forced to take care of. Not forced to, but. She's taken on the role of a carer for her younger brothers. She's been moved from foster home to foster home to foster home. She doesn't trust adults. She trusts herself, and that's basically it. And I think that's far more interesting than, you know, Wendy Darling, who's been looked after her whole life and doesn't have any responsibility. And that the original, I think the original Wendy, the point was to teach Wendy responsibility. And this Wendy, it's like letting go of some of that responsibility,
yeah.
which is really great. And yeah, she's snarky and she's moody and she's stroppy, but she's also very, very vulnerable. And
is there an aspect, do you think, where... my reading of Peter Pan is that Wendy and Peter are the kind of key figures in the piece, but they're also the kind of same person in some ways.
Yeah, massively.
Peter's like a future projection of...
Yeah,
Wendy
I think
wants to be, maybe.
Wendy needs to see herself from... outside of herself to be able to realise that what she's doing and how she's treating people and to see the problems that she's causing. And she needs to, and she kind of projects that out and it becomes Peter Pan. So all the cockiness and the nonchalance and the, like, that comes from Wendy. That comes, they're two sides of the same coin.
Mic check 1, 2, 1, 2. 0121, what you saying, my brummies? Yo, big man Pan, get my Neverland crew. Let's do it. Let's build Wendy a house.
Wendy a house.
Gotta make sure that she likes it. Let's build Wendy a house.
Wendy a house.
Gotta make sure it's the nicest. Let's get on with the work.
On with the work.
Gotta make this place not priceless. We gotta make it safe.
Make it safe.
Make sure we have no crisis. You've gotta piece it, you've gotta lift it. You've gotta roll it, you've gotta fix it. You gotta lick it. Hey Nibs,
huh?
Stop eating all them biscuits.
Oh.
What should we put inside? Everything nice. Maybe a pool, maybe a slide. When trouble comes, double up. Gotta do everything twice. You gotta hammer, hammer. Gotta screw, screw. Gotta wind. Windy, windy, gotta move, move. You gotta crank, crank. Gotta twist, twist. You gotta mix that. You gotta fix this. Ah, get it? Gotta make sure that it's ready. Gotta make it nice and steady. Cause we gotta build a house for our Wendy. Let's build Wendy a house.
Wendy a house.
Gotta make sure that she likes it. Let's build Wendy a house.
Wendy a house.
Gotta make sure it's the nicest. Let's get on with the work.
On with the work.
Gotta make this place not priceless. We gotta make it safe.
Make it safe.
Make sure we have no crisis. We're from Neverland. I'm Peter Pan on Neverland. Happy thoughts, good times, sick rhymes. Your bad vibes won't ever land. We're from Never Never, where we never say never never. Want Wendy to stay forever. Lost ones now, all together, make it better. We gotta build Wendy a house.
Wendy a house.
Gotta make sure that she likes it. Let's build Wendy a house.
Wendy a house.
Gotta make sure it's the nicest. Let's get on with the work.
On with the work.
Gotta make this place not priceless. We gotta make it safe.
Make it safe.
Make sure we have no crisis.
Right, right. going back to the point about this being about motherhood and mothers, Hook is a kind of, in some ways, I guess, is a representation of frustration and anger in terms of things that motherhood stops you doing.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, she is the way I play her, and there's a very telling tiny little soliloquy where she says, we get the idea that she has given up motherhood in order to be this sort of famed pirate. And I mean, that certainly chimes. I think certainly in this profession, I know a lot of women who end up not having children because they are chasing this profession. And I'm lucky. I have a family. I have a little boy, so I'm very, very lucky. But there are a lot of women who just haven't. It hasn't happened, and it's the way I'm playing Hook. There, we do get a breath that she would like to have experienced what motherhood was. So yeah, there's a flavour of that running through this Hook because it's in the lines and. So I play it. So yeah, it's you know, motherhood's very difficult, and we see that in all its forms here, I think.
And I think in a similar way that Peter's projected from Wendy, Hook is projected from Jess, who's the other part that Nia plays, who's Wendy's foster mum, and Wendy's sort of villainized her in her head, and she's made Jess the villain in this story. And through living and through Neverland and Peter, she realizes that Jess isn't the villain. And I think but she needs to project Hook for her to realize that Jess isn't a villain. I think that's as well.
Yeah, it's complex, isn't it?
It's very complex.
Stuff.
It's a lot
of fun as well.
We need to stress
that there are mermaids flying, there's rap.
There's rock star pirates.
There's street dancing.
There are some brilliant tunes in the...
Oh, yeah.
Some thumping, really banging tunes, yeah.
And some beautiful harp playing as well. Other tunes that aren't quite as heavy. Yeah.
And I was going to ask you just finally. We talked a bit about the kind of set and the scene and the environment, but props are an important part in this, aren't they? Really, as they are for most productions. But what I mean by that is, I mean, there's a really important prop. It's probably the biggest prop I've seen. But the crocodile, for example, there's a really sort of recycled element to a lot of these bits. But the crocodile, without giving too much away, is very frightening, but also very recognisable.
Yeah, we won't give it away then.
No, we won't give it away.
But it's big enough for me to get eaten by it.
Yes.
And I do get eaten by it. The whole design, I think Michael Pavelka, the designer, and Laura, who designed the costumes, and the director, Liam Steele, there was very much a sense that anything that populated Neverland was something that threw an echo to something you'd see in everyday life. So you will see empty milk bottles being used. You will see plastic cups being used.
You'll see washing up powder.
Washing up powder boxes.
Yeah.
So there is everything that appears in Neverland. There's an idea that it's something that Wendy would have seen in everyday life. And then she's rinsed it through her imagination and it's become something magical. So
you're in Peter Pan Reimagined until the 19th of January.
Yes.
That's a very long run.
It's two shows a day, people.
Two shows a day.
Yes.
Come and spend some time with us.
Even Elvis struggled, I think, with that.
Yeah, I know how Elvis feels.
Elvis didn't have to fly.
So just finally, just one last question, if I can. Just what is it about Peter Pan that you think endures? We talked about some of the themes and some of the kind of topics, but what is it you think that it still sparks that kind of feeling in people? Is it the strength of the characters or what?
Yeah, and it's about friendship and family and hope and all the things that make people want to watch it. And no matter how you're doing it and where it's set and who's playing it, and those are the themes that will always run through it. It's always going to be about family and about friendship. And yeah, I think that's something that you're always going to want to watch.
Yeah, and there's a, there's a the baddies are really good. The heroes are you want to hang out with them. There are fairies, you know. It's got everything, you know.
So it's magical.
It is magical.
It's really magic. Magical.
Well, excellent. It's been great to talk to you both.
You
and
too.
I shall let you now get back to the cutlasses
and bungees. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Break a leg.
Happy Christmas, everyone.
Happy Christmas.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
For more information and tickets, you can go to www.birmingham-rep.org.uk or you can contact their box office on 0121 236 4455. Peter Pan Reimagined runs until Sunday, the 19th of January, 2020. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Cora, Nia and the cast and crew at the Birmingham Repertory Theatre, Sajan at Grand Union Digbeth, and Asaf Sahir for exclusive use of his music from the production. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.